Right. I think we have been good enough to come back on time, and given the that we have already taken 15 minutes of April's presentation, we should stick to the presentation and get her going quickly. Thanks, April, for your kind accommodation.
Okay, that's fine. And because we are a bit strapped for time, we're doing this in 15 minutes or less. I think you flick through the slides together, and to the extent that you do have a question, then just leap in or a comment as we go along. The purpose of this presentation is to just update you as to where we've got in the post-implementation review process since I last saw you in November. Slide two, just to remind you a bit about the post-implementation process, it was brought in 2007 by the trustees, and it was largely in response to the furore that had arisen when we first issued IFRS 8. The original requirement was that we'd only look at contentious issues and unexpected implementation issues when we were doing the post-implementation review, but this is the first one, and so when we consulted with people in Q1 of last year, it became clear that you couldn't just go back to people and ask them about contentious issues or restrict the review in any way. And so when the trustees met in April, they decided that they'd widen the objective of the review to include whether or not the standard had achieved its objective and whether it had improved financial reporting. And they also thought that we should do a public consultation on the subject. That was called a request for information. We wanted evidence of what people thought about the standard. And most people, when they gave us that information, they also gave us examples from published sets of financial statements of good and bad points about the standard. On slide three, what were the effects of implementing IFRS 8? You may remember IFRS 8 obviously is based on how you manage the business internally. The segments are identified based on the segments that are used internally to make decisions. The line items reported are those used by the decision makers, and they're measured at the internal measurement amount. The board adopted this standard for a number of reasons. They thought that it would give people a better understanding of the business. There'd be fewer single segment companies because they didn't think that anyone actually in their internal reporting didn't do any disaggregation. It would be easier, and so there'd be more information for interims. And, of course, the original one of the original objectives was it would give you the same basis of disaggregation as U.S. businesses. There were a couple of concerns that we were aware of when it was issued. One was that geography would disappear. Under IAS 14, you had to give two analyses, one by product, one by geography. Under IFRS 8, there is only one analysis, and that's how you measure the business. And some people were concerned that there'd be a lack of comparability between entities. As I said, we did, on slide four, we did modify the review process last year so that the first stage we established what we thought the sort of issues were that we needed to investigate. We did that by looking at the available literature, the educational material that the firms put out, articles that had been published at the time. And we did a lot of outreach events with a number of different organizations, including this one, just to think about what sort of things we should be looking at in this process. About April or May of last year, we went into the investigation phase, which is where we put out the request for information, and we also did a lot of outreach to get people's views in. The public consultation, the request for information, was published in July. It has a snazzy purple color as opposed to most of our usual documents, and the comment period ended on the 16th of November. And in January, the staff took to the ISB the analysis of the comment letters received and an outreach summary, and also a review of the available literature and the academic research. Slide five. We'd asked six questions in the request for information. They were based really on the key technical decisions that underlie the standard, how you identify your segments, how you measure them, what line items you disclose. We also asked actually for information about the respondents, which we don't generally do, because segment information is so important to people that people who were not IFRS users or people who were only partway along the transition path to IFRS also wanted to be involved in the process. And knowing where they were in that stage would allow us to take their comments in context. So slide six, the responses that we had by geography. I think as you might expect, we had a lot of responses from Europe. Europe has been using IFRSs for a very long time, obviously, so they were very involved in the process itself. But all of the geographical regions were pretty well represented, the exception perhaps being North America. We got very few or relatively few responses from North America, and the responses we did get were actually from Canada. And we think that's principally because the objective of, one of the objectives of the standard had been to converge with US GAAP, so there isn't a difference with US GAAP. So there'd be no particular merit in US respondents taking part. And also, of course, the FASB's trustee foundation, the FAF, were in the process at the time of doing a post-implementation review of their own standard, which we'll look at in a moment. On slide seven, respondents by type, 35% of the respondents were preparers of financial statements, which for us is rather lower than usual. And we've had a couple of comments on that. Some people say it's simply because the standard works very well and there's no particular benefit in preparers taking part in this process. Our normal consultation is when we're developing an ED of what the standard will be. And some people thought that preparers would be more inclined to be involved in that because there they can see that what they're saying will have an effect on the standard setting process, whereas this consultation wasn't that sort of developmental effect. There were also some people who expressed concern that preparers might be reticent, given that they had been using the standard for at least 3 years, to actually now come back and say what they had had problems with in case there were regulatory issues or there were problems in their filed financial statements. Otherwise, we had quite a good spread of consultation. 62 as the number of responses, that's rather low for one of our public consultations. In the heady days when I was on revenue recognition, we could get 1,000, which made you feel much more appreciated.
Even the form letters.
But I think this probably, you know, reflects the fact that this is a sort of a retrospective look back at what we've done. And there were also some people who thought, well, given that this is the first, we don't really know what our involvement should be or what it is that we're meant to say. We did do quite a bit of outreach to try and bring in a wide range of people. We had over 60 consultations in total, 35 of which were looking at evidence. And we had quite a broad spectrum of discussion forums, webcasts, different ways of getting in touch with people about that. So on slide eight, the first of the messages, and talk a little faster because we're running out of time. The first message really that we got, which I suppose was no surprise, is that segment information is probably the most important note for a lot of investors in the entire financial statements. It's really fundamental to people who are making decisions about where they invest. We'd also found that in a number of jurisdictions, a portion of companies didn't change at all. And we think a lot of this may simply be that, particularly if you're in big corporates, you like to have a streamlined, systematized financial reporting process. And we think quite a few entities had already set up their reporting systems on an IAS 14 basis, so that when we changed and said, right, report on how you report internally, they just carried on with the same methodology. Having said that, the messages we then got on segmentation were a bit mixed. In general, I think preparers like IFRS 8. It was easy for most of them to do because the information was already available. And some preparers also thought that it was very useful because it helped them discuss things with investors and communicate more effectively with people. And generally, the incremental costs of transitioning to IFRS 8 were quite low. Investors had mixed views. One message that we got very strongly was that when the management commentary, the presentations to investors, and the segment analysis in the financial statements are all aligned. But that gave people a lot of comfort. There was more information in the management commentary, but the fact that it agreed with the audited segment disclosure note gave comfort to investors in that area. To the extent they didn't align, and there are some sectors in particular where that doesn't happen, that caused concern both to investors and to regulators. There were some regulators who specifically went back and asked people, how are you actually managing this business if your management commentary is on one basis and your IFRS 8 notice on another? There were some jurisdictions where investors were very suspicious of the management basis. They were suspicious of management intent, and that was particularly noticeable if the segments didn't line up between the different types of reporting that people see. There was probably more geographical information in the segments than expected. People had, particularly in Europe, had been very concerned that there wouldn't be sufficient geographical information. The academic research didn't come to a conclusion as to whether or not there was enough. On the one hand, there are some people who, because they had the geographical information available, just carried on churning it out because it didn't cost them anything. It was already there. It was already systematized. And there was also some requirements in IFRS 8 that you have to give your revenues and your non-operating assets by geography. And by and large, that's the sort of information that people want by geography anyway. The final thing is that there is a lot of complaint about identification of the chief operating decision maker. The chief operating decision maker is the sort of the fundamental definition of the person that you're presenting or the function that you're presenting the information to. And there are a number of people who say it's very difficult to identify a chief operating decision maker. Now, having said that, most of the IFRS respondents said that once you've got to that stage, it's no problem. You decide what your segments are and you just keep going. And I did have a preparer in one of the Scandinavian outreaches who said to me, in applying the standard, he didn't have a problem in identifying what his segments were because he knew what that was. It was the segments that they looked at all the time internally. But having taken that definition of his segments, he couldn't then go backwards and define who the CODM was because depending on what type of decision it was, that might be a different body or a different person or a different level. There was also some concern, particularly with investors, about aggregation. There was a view that there's too much aggregation and that, in particular, people were aggregating segments, operating segments, which didn't have similar characteristics. On slide 9, messages received about line items. The biggest single message that we got from investors, and it's partly a gap in IFRSs at the moment, because we haven't really addressed performance reporting itself, there isn't a commonly held operating profit definition. And so one European study, for example, showed that there were 15 common definitions being used, EBIT, EBITDA, all sorts of things. Very common in an operating result for people to add back operating exceptional items. And we got two messages from investors. Some think it's useful to have those adjusted figures because they're only interested in what they see as being the underlying continuing operating profits. Others, of course, were quite suspicious that it was covering up information. And then there was a general sort of response. Because IFRS 8 is maybe measured on a different basis and the line items may be differently defined, and there may be some segments which don't qualify as reporting segments, the reconciliations can be quite complex. Some preparers thought they were difficult to do, and I don't know if that's your view. Many investors found that they were difficult to understand. But throughout the comments we received on reconciliations, a number of people came back to saying probably the biggest problem with the reconciliations is that people aren't complying with the standard and that a lot of the issues on reconciliations are one of enforcement. Slide 10, academic research. We did do a review of the academic research. There were fewer single-segment entities, which is good. There was no change in the number of reported segments for most companies, but in general, if they did change, there was an increase. Some key line items did stop being reported, particularly CapEx and liabilities. And as I said, there was mixed evidence about whether the geographical disclosures are adequate. On slides 11 and 12, we look at the US, who are also doing a review of their equivalent standard, which is FAS 131. Now, it's very difficult for us to sort of link our processes in any way or to compare our conclusions in too much depth, because both the objective and the process themselves are quite different. The objective of ours is really much broader, to look at the entire effect of the standard on its area of financial reporting. The FASB are in particular looking at how effective the standard setting process itself is. Our process is done by IASB staff, and it's assisted by constituents. The trustees were quite clear that this is part of the standard setting process, and as such is the responsibility of the IASB. Whereas the FASB, it's performed by the trustee staff. It's done principally through third-party consultants. It is entirely confidential. The FASB themselves do not know who was consulted or indeed what the questions were that were asked. They employ consultants. They are given a list of, I think, 15 or 20,000 companies to circulate, and they go through and the consultants select people within that range to circulate, 6 or 7,000, I think it was. I think they got something like a 1% response, but we don't know who that response was. We don't know what questions they were asked. So, and some people think that's a better idea, because if you've got that confidentiality, people will be honest. They will be brutally honest. I think our trustees took the view that it was better to actually know what information the IASB received, so that you could assess what conclusions they drew from that process and what messages they thought were learned from that process. Slide 12, the results of the review of the US standards. They published their review in January 2013. As I said, there are only the top level messages. The messages seem to be quite similar to ours, but because there isn't that depth of detail or examples, it's very difficult really for us to compare them, because ours is a much more detailed and much more specific sort of data set of information coming in. The US have come back and said that they think the major difficulties are identifying and aggregating segments and lack of some key line items. And we do continue to liaise with the trustee staff on this issue. The FASB staff at the moment are working on the FASB's formal response to their trustees about how we should liaise going forward. I mean, the other real difference, obviously, between our two processes is timing. We aim to do our post-implementation review 2 to 3 years after it's applied globally. And we've had some people say that's too soon, because there isn't enough financial reporting for investors and academics to actually do statistical quantitative research on what the effect was. Other people say that's too late, because preparers will have forgotten what they actually went through 2 or 3 years ago. So at the moment, we're sort of treading this line of 2 to 3 years. By contrast, the US standard was introduced in 1997. So how much people could actually remember when they were filling in the questionnaire, I don't know about what the effect of implementing that standard would be. Slide 13, what have we learnt? The process actually seems to have held up quite well overall. Timing, we've had different people saying whether or not the timing is right. The methodology, which is quite widespread, we do the public consultation with the RFI, we do outreach. We do a lot of this partnering with firms, with local standard setters, a lot of public discussion forums, which are quite useful. IFRS 3 will be the next one. Now, IFRS 3 was amended in 2008, and it was quite a restricted amendment in 2008. But I think by analogy with the process we've used with IFRS 8, we will have to consult on the entire standard. We're not going to be able to say to people, we are only interested in the 2008 standards. At the moment, we think we'll be doing the same approach. We haven't yet taken the feedback statement to the ISB. We expect to do that in April, and once we have an appreciation of the ISB's view on that feedback that they received, then I think we'll be better able to know what approach will be taken for IFRS 3. We expect that to commence sometime in quarter two or quarter three of this year. And as always, of course, we'll need your help when we get to that process. So I'm afraid we haven't quite done the 15 minutes, but any questions?
Yes, Bob.
I had a question, and then secondly, it was mostly a comment that would be followed up by a question. A quick question was in review of academic research. Was there any academic research that looked at the cost of capital from changing the standards? And I'll just follow up my kind of comment question. I know we're in the early stages of this from both boards, and we've done FIN 48 in the U.S. and now 131, and you've done segments. I've been kind of surprised, just basically, I don't know if this is the exact way to say it, but everything's hunky-dory, as a term, I don't even know if that translates, with these standards. And in the U.S., when we get these, when they hand the request for information, they're like 10 to 12 pages long with like, I don't know, I'd say 100 questions on them. And you get that, and you got a laundry list of your day activities, and you know, that'd be nice to do. It's an important thing. It's just difficult to get at. And I kind of go back and try and remember when these standards were implemented. And like FIN 48, I know I'm a little off topic, but one of the big issues there was the taxing authority supposedly had perfect knowledge of your tax situation, which is just not reality, but that didn't really come up in the review. And then I thought I remember 131, and maybe it was with IFRS 8, is people are going to be worried about competitive harm. And so what I'm getting at is, and I know it's not black and white, but either we as preparers, and I'll present it black and white, although it's not black and white, we as preparers are full of bunk when we comment during the comment period of all these dire consequences are going to happen and they don't happen. Or there's maybe something in between. And I guess what I'm saying is a suggestion that I think you got to think long and hard of how to get more preparer interaction with this. And this is not a suggestion you can act on, but it's almost like here's your comment letter. None of these things happen. Why not? Why didn't you think they happened? And that's not the answer. But this is so important. It's the first few examples are kind of showing that within the community, it's not being taken as important as I think it is. And I'm a little concerned. I'm just based on a real small population, but it's my personal opinion.
Any suggestions how to improve that? I think your point on the preparers is very fair, but I think on the IFRS 8, that's, in my mind, it's more of an aberration than what's going to be the case in other situations.
I think for IFRS 3, which was, I think, more contentious for preparers, there may be more response. I also think that we took into account a lot of your points, and that the first stage that we did was we went back to the original comment letters to find out what the anticipated issues had been. And when we drafted the RFI for the different questions underneath, we did put for preparers, some people thought this would happen, did it happen? Some people thought that would happen. And I think, really, we can't judge our own process by anything that's happened in the U.S. process. The U.S. process really hasn't, I don't think, collected information which is valuable to us in any way in assessing things because there's no transparency. And, I mean, our summary of the comments received was over 51 pages. So we haven't just, unlike the FAF report, which is just sort of about 6 pages long, and which, as you say, does say everything is hunky-dory, in ours we have actually identified a number of issues for each of the areas. And in the feedback statement, we will then, I think, give the board's assessment of what the responses to that should be. So I think the fact that we've got a very positive response for the FAF on their statement doesn't actually reflect the depth of investigation, I think, that we've put into our thing. I agree about the preparers. I think, personally, that it's simply because, by and large, IFRS 8 is working well for preparers, so they're not that interested in coming back and saying anything about it. I suspect for IFRS 3, we may find some people who are more affected by it will actually show much more interest in responding.
Yeah, Mary?
I was going to ask whether, even if it's more complex, if it would make sense to try and collect feedback on transition shortly after the mandatory date, but then hold the effectiveness for a longer period of time, especially in part to allow for more academic research, which I thought the paper on academic research, the updated one that came back in January, I thought was really good. I can't remember the answer to your question about cost of capital, but it was really an exhaustive review of the literature, and that paper's public. Whether we should just try and collect, maybe even via some variant of this group, or outreach via this group, information about expectations and reality of transition, and kind of park that as data to consider when it comes to the effectiveness analysis.
Yeah, the Big Four might be a good idea. Big Four projects, I mean. Yes, Malcolm.
I got a couple of points, but the first one is the process that I'd like to raise, and you mentioned the nice purple booklet. I mean, why was it not distributed to the same people that get the?
He raised this issue. It went to his CFO, and it did not go to him last time.
Exactly. And it was written as if it was just coming from one person and not from sort of, you weren't interested in getting comments from industry groups or something. So I felt you almost made it too restrictive in the RFI.
And certainly, I mean, one of the lessons that we've learned about the discussions, you're right, in the RFI under each question, we had put investors thought this, what do you think? Preparers thought this, what do you think? And a lot of people interpreted that as saying we don't want to know what accounting firms or standard setters or regulators think. Whereas, in fact, we only put those investor and preparer sort of tags in because we thought that regulators and the accounting firms would be better able to adapt to what is a new consultation process and that they wouldn't have so many problems. And we thought it was helpful specifically for investors and preparers to identify issues which they raised at comment letters and whether they would want to comment to them again. I think going forward in future, we have to make it absolutely clear that the tags that we're putting in and the prompts we're putting in are applicable to anybody.
Yeah, and you know, I think you should send it to everyone that gets this too, just from a distribution point.
I mean, I'll make a note of that because certainly our policy now is that we're doing relatively few hard copies of anything because so many people get things on the website. And I think for the RFI, we only had one.
Yeah, but
but that's obviously,
I believe, you know, if you don't get a hard copy, you get a notification that this is now available. And I believe in this case of the post-implementation review, perhaps. I don't even think you got it electronically, that it was on the website.
Did you send the electronic alerts?
There certainly should have been email alerts and everything, but I'll check.
Then the next question, which is, I mean, this one's a bit of a nasty question, but it's something we talked about earlier in our group. The initial intention of IFRS 8 was to conform to US GAAP. So where are we now if US GAAP happens to change? Are you going to continue conforming to US GAAP, or are you going to go your own way?
They weren't actually 100% converged, and there are some people who've said, what's the point of converging disclosure if the elements themselves aren't converged? But certainly we are in discussions with the FAF staff about where they're getting to in their report, and the FASB in their letter of response to their trustees have said that they will continue to monitor what we're doing with a view to keeping us converged. The sort of things that would come out of the feedback statement for potential adjustment, obviously, here, they would have to go into an assessment process that compared them with other matters that were on the IASB potential work plan to see how what priority should be given to them. So they would also go through that assessment process. But yes, we are aware that we need to keep at least aware of what the FASB are doing, so that to the extent the IASB were to do something different, they would do that in the full knowledge that it would create divergence.
Last question to Hiroshi.
I think the number of responses is 62, and it's a little small, and responsible preparers are small. I think that this just because they are satisfied with IFRS 8, and in Japan, ASB asks some questions to companies. They are generally satisfied with IFRS 8, and the question I have that there are some views requesting more geographical information or the operating cash flow information. I think it's not a majority view, it's a kind of a minority view. Some information such as geographical profit disappeared. If it is not management by controlled by management. And regarding the segment information of operating cash flow, from the perspective of cost of benefit, it's not practical. So I'm a little concerned with the movement of the IFSB. You may remember in a project or financial statement presentation, they proposed 2 or 3 years ago much detail. They are asking of detailed information of each cash flow. So I think that the direction was not supported by related parties. So I'm just curious how the result of the analysis is used. Reflecting, it's some of the comments are minority views, and people are satisfied to not provide their voices.
And that is a concern, that there may be a silent majority out there who are quite happy. I think in reading the sort of the analysis, I think